You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hillary Clinton is in the news this week, not just for her presidential campaign, but because of her ongoing email scandal during her time as Secretary of State. We'll look at the new Inspector General's report and how it could affect her campaign.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. It's the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Lots of legal action this week as the state dealt with challenges to voter ID laws and a redistricting process that took place back in 2011. And the state of Wisconsin joined a lawsuit against the Obama administration about the federal government's policy on bathroom rules.
Laurel White joins us now to get us up to speed on these stories. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, I know you spent a lot of time this week at the state's voter ID trial. What is at the heart of this particular legal challenge?
Yeah, so the 9-day trial wrapped up yesterday, and the heart of the challenge was the claim that the liberal groups bringing the suit, saying that the voter ID law discriminates against certain populations of people. So minorities, young people, people who tend to vote for Democratic candidates.
And we heard some people give testimonies this week. Can you round up what people had to say?
Sure. Yeah, it's rough to round up 9 days of testimony, but basically they had expert witnesses on each side of the argument. So expert witnesses for the plaintiff saying that the law does discriminate, does put barriers in place for certain populations of people. Expert witnesses for the state, kind of questioning the methodology of the expert witnesses on the other side. And then there were stakeholders on both sides. So people for the plaintiff saying that they were affected by the laws, that the laws made it harder for them to vote. And then for the state, people who work for the state who implement the laws and say that they're working really hard to make it easier for people to get to the polls.
And what did some of these voting clerks have to say about how the law worked? Did they report any problems?
Sure. Yeah. So that was a really interesting part of the trial, actually, because there were county clerks that testified for both sides, for the plaintiffs and the defense. So the Madison City clerk testified for the plaintiffs, and she said that the voter ID law has the potential to lengthen wait times at the polls. And that there were some challenges there. And then there were some more kind of suburban and rural county clerks, towns like Cedarburg and Port Washington, that testified for the state saying, you know, these new laws that are questioned in the case actually make it easier for them to do their jobs in some respects. So that was an interesting breakdown, seeing how county clerks fell on both sides of the argument.
And one thing at issue here was voter fraud, and Republicans saying that the law was needed because they need to combat voter fraud in the state, and the voter ID does that. Other people, Democrats, saying, is there really voter fraud? So what did you hear in terms of that?
That's right. Well, that part got really wonky. That was where a lot of the expert witnesses came in. And expert witnesses for the plaintiffs argued consistently that voter fraud really isn't very common. Of course, it depends on how you define voter fraud. And so a lot of the expert witnesses for the state said, well, it does exist. Here are some examples. And there was a lot of back and forth on that particular issue.
And you mentioned hearing from some people in the state, citizens who testified about how they used the law and whether or not the law prevented them from getting an ID. Can you tell us about one or two of the people that testified about their ability to get an ID card?
Sure. So there was a woman who testified who has been working for quite a while. I believe it was actually about 5 years to get her father an ID card for voting. And the issue there is that the name on his birth certificate doesn't match the name that he's been using for his entire life. So that's a challenge that some people have been facing when they're trying to provide the documentation necessary to get a photo ID from the state. And there are just a lot of, it seems, hoops and things when you have that kind of discrepancy in your vital documents. So she was walking the court through that process that she said was really difficult for her and her father and kept her father from voting.
And what do we know about whether this case could possibly impact elections in August and, of course, November?
Sure. So the judge in the case, Judge James Peterson, addressed that yesterday as things were wrapping up, and he said he plans to issue his decision in late July. So that's not going to come in time to affect the partisan primary, which is on August 9th. So as far as we know, full steam ahead, everything's going to be the same. Of course, we expect the case to be appealed to a higher court, whatever the decision is. So stay tuned.
It's the Wisconsin News Roundup, and we're talking with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White right now. And another case this week going on at the same time. This is a case regarding Wisconsin's voting districts. Now, can you refresh us, Laurel, about this one?
Yes, we have a lot of legal challenges happening this week and last. So my bureau chief, Sean Johnson, has been sitting in on the redistricting trial. It's in its last day today. I believe they're actually getting ready to start closing arguments right now. Essentially, what's happening in this case is that Democrats in the state are alleging that Republicans got too partisan when they redrew the districts, the legislative districts in the state in 2011.
And what did you hear about the process that was used for drawing these districts and about who did it?
Sure. So Republicans were in charge of the redistricting, of the drawing of the maps. And we heard some testimony, or the court heard some testimony earlier this week from an aide to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. And he outlined how the process worked. Basically, it was aides for Republicans working in a law office across the street from the Capitol, drawing up the maps, conferring with Republican legislators. Apparently, no Democratic legislators were involved, which has been a point of contention in the case.
Anything to add about what the rationale was used, what sort of standards were used in redrawing the districts?
Sure. Well, Republicans are saying that they used, mathematical formulas that can be proven, that they weren't being partisan, that it's all fair and good. And the argument being made by Democrats in this case is kind of a wonky one. They're trying to prove something called the efficiency gap. And I could talk all day about this, but it's basically about the number of votes that are cast and how that compares to the number of legislative victories. And they think that there's a disconnect there, and that proves that the maps are unfair.
So where does this one go next?
So they're expecting this case to will be appealed, whatever the outcome is. So it's going to be another long process.
And finally this week, Laurel, Wisconsin has joined 10 other states in suing the federal government over bathroom rules. This relates to transgender bathroom use in particular. And what are these states challenging? What is Wisconsin doing here?
Sure. So this was earlier this week. Basically, what the states are challenging, it's Wisconsin and 10 other states, some non-binding guidance from the federal government that came out earlier this month. That was the Department of Education and the Department of Justice saying that federal Title IX laws, which protect students from sex discrimination, should apply to transgender students who want to use a locker room or a restroom that corresponds with their gender identity rather than their biological sex. And some states are pushing back and saying that that's not an accurate application of the Title IX law and that it's taking away sovereignty from the states.
And what did Attorney General Brad Schimel have to say about why Wisconsin was jumping in on this?
Sure. So he mentioned, that it was taking away the state's sovereignty. He used some really strong words in a statement that he issued. He said, "Obama's attempts to rewrite the laws of our country without congressional consent and approval are not going to be tolerated." And he called it a power grab by the Obama administration. So he was very passionate in his conviction that Wisconsin should be challenging this along with the 10 other states.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, the State Capitol reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and she joined us for a look at the biggest stories of the week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, summer movie season is here, and there's lots of fun-sounding movies coming out this summer, from Independence Day Resurgence to the kids' movie Finding Dory. We're going to talk to a critic and get his recommendations.
First, while Hillary Clinton is ahead in the Democratic presidential primary, her campaign has been dogged by her days as the Secretary of State when she used a private email server and email address during her tenure.
And a new report released this week has found that Clinton broke government rules by using a private server.
Joining us now to talk about the ongoing Clinton email story is Josh Gerstein, senior reporter for Politico. He's been covering this issue for a good long while. Josh, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, good to be back with you. It seems like I've been covering it for a long, long time.
Well, Josh, this new report comes. This is something that people on both sides of the political fence have been watching closely. What was at stake in this new report? Who was doing this investigation? What did we find out?
Well, this was the State Department's Office of Inspector General. People that weren't following this closely may have not been aware that this investigation was even pending out there. Folks have probably heard that the FBI is investigating Hillary Clinton's email setup. That seems to be on the issue of classified information. This really had to do with the State Department's policies of how it makes and keeps its official records. To some extent, it has to do with whether those records are available for people who file Freedom of Information requests. But it's really broader than that, which is whether the State Department has a full and complete record of the way it does its business. And the report essentially found that Hillary Clinton's email setup violated established policy at the State Department. She has said repeatedly that her use of this email server was permitted or allowed under State Department rules. And this report basically disagreed, said that, you know, there were situations where you were allowed to use your personal email, but the rules made clear since at least 2005 that you could not routinely conduct your day-to-day business on a, you know, private or informal or commercial even email system. You had to use one of the approved State Department systems.
Yeah, big picture, Josh, this isn't, I guess, devastating for Hillary Clinton, but it's not good. It doesn't look good what they found.
No, there was no, like, huge smoking gun. There was no direct evidence that she or her top staffers, you know, told people not to report this or something along those lines, or there was some discussion of doing something illegal or improper. But it did contradict what has been, as I say, one of her key talking points on this issue for more than a year, that this was permitted under State Department rules. And there were some details in here that were sort of unflattering to her. Number one was that she and her top aides declined to cooperate with this investigation, which is a little bit strange given how she has said that she has nothing to hide and that she's happy to discuss the issue. Her people say that's because she wanted to prioritize the FBI investigation. I think that means she didn't quite trust the people that were doing this report. And there were some other details in there that at least at the sort of mid to lower levels of the State Department, some people did raise concerns about this setup during her time there. And they were basically, in polite terms, told to shut up. The report says that at least one of them was told never to raise the subject again. Again, we don't know that that kind of an instruction came from on high, but at least within the State Department bureaucracy, some people were not interested in discussing this issue.
And one thing that seems to come out of this is a lot of this was done because Hillary Clinton wanted to keep using a BlackBerry to conduct business, and she couldn't get a secure one from the government, so that's why she was doing it through this private email server. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a complex series of explanations, but part of it does come down to the fact that her offices at the State Department were considered a SCIF, a secure information facility, essentially, for handling classified information. And in order to avoid various types of espionage, basically, they don't allow you to bring in any outside devices. I've been up there, and there's basically a bunch of cubby holes, and you have to sort of lock your phone in a cubby hole before you go into that space. And apparently those same rules were imposed on her and her staff when they came in to office. The rules had sort of varied over the years, but they seemed to be strict about it at that point. And one of her issues was that she had no experience using a computer, believe it or not, at least to get email. And so she'd become used to the BlackBerry, and at the beginning of her tenure, there was a lot of back and forth about how she could keep it, and eventually they decided, well, you can keep using it, but you'll have to basically go out in the hall when you want to check your messages. What's not clear is whether the people who were setting it up knew that this was going to essentially become her official email account, even though it was being hosted on a server, you know, a couple hundred miles away at her home in Chappaqua, New York.
Some of the biggest exposure BlackBerry's gotten in some years. In a phone interview with MSNBC's Chuck Todd yesterday, Hillary Clinton had this to say about this news and about the ongoing email story.
I said this many times. It was still a mistake. If I could go back, I'd do it differently. And I understand people have concerns about this, but I hope and expect voters to look at the full picture of everything I've done and stand for and the full threat posed by Donald Trump. And if they do, I have faith in the American people that they will make the right choice.
Hillary Clinton talking about this new news on the ongoing email scandal. Josh Gerstein from Politico is with us. And Josh, talking about this, she mentions Donald Trump and a lot of people, I think, on her side, on the Democratic side in general, are framing this whole email issue as a partisan political issue. And as we see this campaign go forward, that's what it's going to be, isn't it?
Well, there's no question it's part of that rumble between the Democrats and the Republicans. I don't know, the report that came out, you know, her people haven't really sharply criticized it, even though they were clearly nervous about it. And there are people on the Hill who are Republicans who are pushing to look into this. Of course, the FBI investigation, Hillary Clinton's people are saying they trust that investigation and they trust the FBI to get it right. So there are different actors involved here that at least are not explicitly partisan. But you're quite right. I mean, immediately Donald Trump started capitalizing on this report and saying it was not good news for Hillary Clinton, and he routinely calls her Crooked Hillary. So these are clearly the kinds of headlines he's trying to put out there, and it's worth remembering that she is kind of underwater, at least with the population generally, in terms of their trust of her. And headlines about you violating the rules obviously seem unlikely to, you know, build support for you in terms of your trustworthiness.
And outside the partisan politics here, it seems like there is a real issue at the State Department, going back some years, even before Hillary Clinton, maybe at their worst with some of what Hillary Clinton's reported to do. Is there a sign that these things are being fixed at the State Department now?
I do think that Secretary John Kerry has made an effort since this became a controversy. I have to say I saw no indication they were, you know, in the process of repairing this problem before this became a front-page story involving Secretary Clinton. There have been numerous reports that those of us who follow these issues are aware of, saying that essentially the State Department's record-keeping systems and their Freedom of Information Act systems were a disaster, to put it politely. It was very common to wait 3, 4, or 5 years to get a response to a request from them. And it turns out that the Secretary's office, not just under Secretary Clinton, but previous secretaries, seems to have been particularly bad at record-keeping, handling those kinds of requests. So it is a problem that goes back many years and many secretaries, very antiquated computer systems. One of the reasons a lot of people who worked at the State Department preferred to use their personal email was that the official email would go down all the time. The computer systems were cumbersome and difficult. You couldn't print things out when you were traveling, and all kinds of logistical hurdles like that that really encouraged people, not just Secretary Clinton, but sort of down the chain of command from her, to rely fairly heavily on their personal accounts, although unlike her, almost all of them did have at least an official account where they did some, perhaps the majority of their business.
Turning back to the political fallout, Josh, you've also written that Donald Trump and Republicans and outside conservative groups are looking to turn this into a summer of scandal for Hillary Clinton with the email and other issues. What do you see happening over the next couple of months?
Well, I mean, even today they have her longtime chief aide, Cheryl Mills, who was chief of staff at the State Department, was a lawyer in the Clinton White House years ago as well, at a deposition, we believe here in Washington, taken by a conservative group handling one of these Freedom of Information Act lawsuits relating to Hillary Clinton's emails. They have a whole series of depositions scheduled of Clinton's top aides and top State Department officials over the next 5 or 6 weeks. There's a request in one case to do a deposition of Clinton herself. There's Clinton possibly being interviewed by the FBI sometime in the next few weeks. And then we're also expecting a Benghazi report that's not strictly about the emails, but the House Benghazi Committee that folks may remember, she did that marathon testimony in front of last year. They've been working on their report, and it's expected to come out sometime over the summer or perhaps early fall. And so it really does become a sort of effort by Republicans, I think, at least in part, to throw as many hurdles in front of her as possible as she tries to build up some momentum to stay ahead of or overtake Donald Trump in the November election.
Both these stories, the email and Benghazi, have been around for quite a while now, and I think everybody has a full understanding of them. Democrats fully understand that they're just partisan witch hunting. Republicans know that there's real scandal unearthed already and waiting to be unearthed. Is any more advertising or court cases or anything like that going to change anyone's mind at this point?
Well, I think it has two effects. One, it does, when Hillary Clinton has to respond to it, like in the interview you just aired, it does take her off whatever she preferred to be talking about that day. I mean, I'm sure she had a message she wanted to be delivering about Donald Trump and which of his positions or the outlandish things that he said recently she wanted to promote and call people's attention to. It becomes a little more difficult for her to do that when people are like, this report, you need to respond to it. What do you say about it? Did you do something wrong? So it does take her off the rhythm of her campaign. And I do think there are questions maybe not about whether people end up voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or switch their support between the sides, depending on these ethical issues. But you think about all the Bernie Sanders supporters out there. You think about some of the anti-insider sentiment that's behind the Trump campaign. And I do wonder if the headlines on these issues might encourage some people maybe to stay home, to not bother voting at all, out of a general sense of disgust over ethics in Washington, or maybe even ethics of billionaires in New York City. And so I do think that is a possibility, probably more than people switching between candidates because of some revelation in these stories at this point.
And briefly, Josh, as we wrap up, any idea when the FBI will do anything, release anything about their investigation into the emails?
Well, we're expecting that if they do interview her, interview Clinton, that'll be sometime in the next few weeks. After that, it's really hard to say. I think they'd ideally like to get this investigation wrapped up well in advance of the November election. They don't customarily release reports on their investigations, so assuming there's no indictment to come out of it, the most we may see is some kind of a letter to Capitol Hill, maybe in a month or 2 months, sort of explaining in very broad brush terms what they found. It probably won't be something that's satisfactory to those who are critics of Clinton's conduct in this particular situation.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime. Have a great weekend.
You too. That's Josh Gerstein, senior reporter for Politico, talking about the latest news on Hillary Clinton's email use while Secretary of State.
Coming up, we'll talk to Reggie the Real Critic about what movies he recommends this summer. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And, of course, we're listening to the theme from the Ghostbusters. This summer, it's going to hit the theaters as a remake of the iconic 80s film featuring a female-led cast. And this remake has attracted a lot of good and bad buzz.
Memorial Day this weekend brings the unofficial summer movie season into full swing. Summer is blockbuster season. You usually see a lot of action movies, some fun kids movies, and usually, yes, franchise installments like the latest X-Men movie coming out this weekend.
And we want to know, what movies are you excited to see this summer? Seems like it's going to be a little bit rainy and murky in Wisconsin, so maybe great movie season, time to hit the theaters if it's raining out. What are you going to go see? What are you looking forward to? What do you want to bring your kids to this summer? Call in now at 800-642-1234 and tell us.
Reggie Ponder joins us now to talk about what he's most excited about this summer. He's known as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo Radio in Chicago, and he critiques movies for several other media outlets. Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, X-Men Apocalypse out today. It's a superhero franchise. I guess we know what we're getting there. A lot of buzz. Anything new and exciting involved in this one that we're hearing about?
What you probably have noticed just in the superhero movies this year has been a battle. It's always about a battle. So you get Batman versus Superman, you got Captain America versus Iron Man, and now you're going to get this character Apocalypse versus the X-Men. So it's Apocalypse will have some former X-Men in fold. So it's almost like each of these franchises are having an internal fight, if you will, or ex-people fighting each other. So that's one thing to look for. And, you know, this is definitely about the action. Everybody's looking to see how this action will play out. But one of the things that I really like about what Marvel is doing with their franchise is that they're understanding that it's not all about the action, that if you can't develop these characters where they become likable and people say, hey, I can identify with the characters, then the action is going to wear out after a while.
I totally agree with you, Reggie, about Marvel doing that, except that I didn't feel like they did that with Captain America. I thought it ended up being just action sequence after action sequence, and even Iron Man was kind of a drag in this one.
Interesting that you would say that. So when I'll take the opposite view to say, when you look at how they introduced Spider-Man into that movie, you say, wow, that was dead on, right on character.
Yeah, that part was good.
When you look at how they introduced Ant-Man into the franchise, into that particular movie, you say, wow, dead on, right on character. And then when you look at Captain America, particularly, he is the moral compass of the franchise. So he had to be who he was in that regard. So I actually think that they're staying true to their character and to their characters and making sure that the dialogue is appropriate for those characters as well. And so you get all this kind of witty banter as you go throughout. I will say to your comment that they have to be careful not to go overboard on the action piece and make sure that they do these little things that I'm talking about.
Well, getting away from superheroes, we could talk superheroes for a long time, but another one out today, Alice Through the Looking Glass. This is a second in a... This is Tim Burton, right? He did an Alice in Wonderland, and this is a new installment. And I think you've seen this one already, right?
Yes, I have. And what I'll say about this is that there's a couple of things, is that Tim Burton actually is producing instead of directing this one. And there, for me, there was a lot of things to like about this movie, but I think overall the bigger question is who wanted to see a sequel? And I'm not really sure that people really want to see a sequel. That one of the magic pieces about books is that books allow you to have an imagination after the story is over. What we seem to like to do from a Hollywood perspective is to say, okay, now we did that, they liked it, let's not allow them to use their imagination. We'll tell them what's going to happen next. And I think some people are very fearful about revisiting Wonderland, because Wonderland is supposed to be wonderful, mysterious, and actually dreaming. You should be dreaming about it, and this might not fit for some folks. But it wasn't as bad as I actually thought. It wasn't going to be good, and I thought that Depp, after seeing this movie, I thought Johnny Depp did a really good job, and it was palatable, if you will.
We're talking with Reggie Ponder right now, and better known as Reggie the Real Critic, and he appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago. And Reggie, let's go to Ghostbusters. So this is one that's got a ton of hype around it, but also detractors who are worried about the premise. Let's listen to a little bit of a clip.
We have a gift. We see what no one else is willing to see. We do things others can't do.
Ghostbusters.
If there's a paranormal problem, we're the ones to answer the call.
The voice of Melissa McCarthy there. She's one of the new Ghostbusters. And Reggie, what's your take on this one?
So it's a mix. I'm actually fighting with myself on this. So in the beginning, this film was actually to star some of the original characters. So a lot of people were thinking, hey, we're going to see Ghostbusters and we'll get Aykroyd and Murray coming back. There's some folks who were like, do we have to see these old guys again? But then there were some folks saying, oh, man, that'd be great to, let's see if we can revisit that a little bit. But if you saw a movie like Dumb and Dumber 2, you'd probably say, nah, maybe not. Maybe not revisit that. So now we got some new characters. And I think that part is cool. The question is, can you really come and do something on the heels of something that was so iconic as Ghostbusters, and will this bastardize the franchise?
And, well, I mean, we've seen, how many Spider-Man reboots over the last few years where they take a new actor and start from scratch again and now again. So does that maybe pave the way for just say, hey, we're taking this concept, we're putting new people in, and, modern special effects technology, and it's something new and fun?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you look at many of these movies, some folks will say, well, if it's been 20, 30 years and most people don't even know about this movie or wouldn't even go back and watch it on Netflix, if you will. So, yeah, let's reboot it. Let's do it again. I think there's a danger in that some of these movies are iconic and classic, and for my money, I'd like to keep them that way. But I'm excited that if you guys have been following this whole issue about women in film, I'm excited that these women particularly are going to get an opportunity to do this, because women account for 54% of the movie-going audience, but when you look at the speaking roles and leading roles for women, it is far less. This is a whole different conversation, because we're talking about blockbusters, but the Hollywood Diversity Report will really shed some light on how the disparity and lack of opportunities for women in film. So I'm happy on that regard that women are leading this particular effort.
And Reggie, before we go on to our next movie, are you worried that if this one doesn't go over so well with women in the leading roles, that Hollywood's going to go, okay, I guess they don't want to see women, and go back to what they were doing before?
Oh, man, so you just opened up a whole can of worms. I have to say I'm not. I think Hollywood's going to do what they're going to do. I think that the pressure is not really enough because it's all about the money. I went to see a couple of superhero films. I have two daughters with my daughters, and the leading characters in those films didn't have toys available for my daughters to purchase. And it really is a commentary on, I think, Hollywood doing what they're going to do. They're going to change, but they change slowly. So I think that this can help the cause. I don't necessarily think it'll hurt it because it's the numbers are not that great in the first place.
Well, here's a movie that will do big dollar numbers, I imagine. I want to give a listen to the follow-up to the 1996 science fiction blockbuster Independence Day, Independence Day Resurgence.
I spent 20 years trying to get us ready for this. We used their technology to strengthen our planet. But it won't be enough.
So they are back, Reggie. The aliens that we've had 20 years to learn, I think one of the trailers said, but so have they. Have we learned to be ready for another Independence Day movie in the last 20 years?
I actually think that this is one that's going to work. I might be wrong, but I think this is going to work because it Jeff Goldblum is back. It has some new characters, and again, they're back. So no one really expected this was a breakout film for Will Smith. No one really expected that this film would be that iconic. So I think that this might do okay at the box office, and the jury will be out. But I think so. Looking at the trailer, and you guys saw it, if the action looks good, I'm excited to see this one.
So I guess another one you're psyched to see, Reggie, is the next Bourne movie back in theaters July 29th. What's going on with this one?
So this is the only movie I'm psyched to see. If they don't make any more movies and just put this one out, I am going to be happy. I am so excited to see this film. And I am not like some folks. I did not like Jeremy Renner and his role. I'm sorry, I'm getting a lot of people behind me. So hold on just one second.
Some shushing going on there.
Yeah,
perhaps?
Just like at the movie theater.
I had to close the door there. I'm sorry. a lot of noise. But in this one, they haven't told us what the plot is yet, but who cares? We know it's Jason Bourne.
And it's Matt Damon, and that's part of what you're excited about.
That's
and
right.
The original director.
The original director is Matt Damon, and they do an uncanny job of making it feel realistic. That even though it's not realistic, you suspend belief thinking that this is realistic. Oh, my goodness, this is happening. Oh, did he do that? Oh, he jumped out of here. Oh, no. I'm so excited.
I want to go to that movie with you.
Yeah, me too.
We're talking to Reggie Ponda right now, known as Reggie the Real Critic, about this year's batch of summer blockbusters.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What movies are you planning to see this summer? Are you as excited as Reggie about the new Bourne movie or any of the other ones we've talked about or any others you know are coming out? And in general, what kind of movies do you like to see in the summer? Do you still go to the theater to see movies? You just wait for them to hit Netflix or DVD or whatever you watch them on. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and take your calls, but first the news with Peter Bryant.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation now with Reggie Ponder, known as Reggie the Real Critic, about movies that are coming out this summer.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you looking forward to? What do you think is going to be a big hit this summer? What are you going to give a miss? And what kind of movies do you like to see when it comes to summertime? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Linda on the line in La Crosse. Linda, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to thank the speaker for letting us know that a new Bourne movie is coming out. I haven't been paying attention to what's coming out in theaters, but I really like those movies too. So I just wanted to let him know there's another fan out there.
Excellent. A fellow fan, Reggie.
Oh, great. You know I'm excited about that.
All right. Well, let's move to some maybe kids movies coming out and give a listen. Now, Finding Nemo, of course, came out. My kids loved that one. It's been a while, and now we've got Finding Dory, a clip from the trailer here.
I don't know why I thought I could do this.
Dory, you are about to find your parents, and when you do that, you'll be
home.
So Pixar, maybe not as magical in the last few years as it used to be. Reggie, do you think we're going to be finding Pixar again with Finding Dory?
I don't. I think that people are going to... These movies are going to make a lot of money. And it's so cute. I mean, even when I get dragged to it, my girls now are older. They're 17 and 20, so we don't, usually won't go to a movie like that. But if I get dragged to a movie like this, the kids love it. So these are almost like can't-miss kind of movies. The what it's going up against sometimes can hurt it, but usually it's almost like recession-proof because you have to take your kids somewhere. It's hot, it's rainy, it's snowy, it's whatever, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, we'll go to the movie. So this will do fine. This will do fine at the box office.
Here's another caller for us. Chris is on the line in Cross Plains. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Question about Secret Life of Pets. Been advertised for months. What do you think that's going to be like?
Okay, Secret Life of Pets, Reggie.
I actually have not heard a lot about it. The studios have not sent us a lot. So I really, you know, my opinion on it is that I don't know as much as I usually know about the films. They usually send us a lot, and when I say a lot, I mean they send us so much almost to try to color our opinion before we see the film, but I haven't seen a lot out on this one, so I apologize.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Robert in De Pere. Robert, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Robert?
I want to bring up the fact that I am not a big fan of the way that Disney, Pixar, whatever they want to call their entities, the movies that they know are kids' favorites, like Finding Dory, The Incredibles, Up, and, you know, all these movies that they are saying, oh, we're going to give you a sequel, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, you already know the brand, you already know the characters and the movies, and it's going to be something fun. Okay, yeah, I would love to take my kids to a movie like that. But the time that there is between that they make the sequel, I understand it takes time to make those movies, but that's ridiculous.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. I guess one advantage of an animated movie is your characters don't really age while you're waiting for that sequel, but why not get that sequel out there sooner, Reggie?
Yeah. His frustration is real. There are a number of folks, but there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that the manufacturing time, actually the time to do it, takes longer. And if you're able to sit in and watch these animators do their job, it does take a longer time to make these movies. But in addition, from a marketing perspective, they're looking at the next group so that they can catch. So if you come out 3 years later, you catch the same kid that you got from the first movie, but then you get this new crop of kids as well. So it's a little bit about marketing as well. So I understand that frustration, and I think it's accurate.
Well, Reggie, let's talk about a movie that I'm super psyched to see, the next Star Trek movie.
Yes.
J.J. Abrams had been attached to these, but I guess he's maybe not directing the next one. What do you know about Star Trek Beyond?
Well, the first thing is that he did a phenomenal job of resurrecting this franchise. I was a little bit skeptical because Abrams is known for doing a whole lot of action sometimes and maybe not the guy to do these iconic films or franchises, if you will. And he did a great job with that one, with Star Trek, but he's also done a great job with Star Wars. So everybody's really actually in anticipation of this one. This is considered... It will be considered a blockbuster. That is, when we talk about the summer, this is one of the movies that people are waiting to see. I'm not as geeked about this one as I am with Jason Bourne. I'm sorry, that's just me. I'm just like bubbling over here about that one. But I can't wait to see this one as well.
Well, another great actor is the bad guy, I understand. We saw Benedict Cumberbatch in one of the new Star Treks, and now Idris Elba of The
right.
Wire, Luther, and maybe speculation, James Bond someday. This could be a really good bad guy.
Yeah. He's going to be good. But the Bond thing, by the way, I think is not going to happen. I've heard a couple of interviews with him, and I don't really think he'll be there from a Bond perspective. But when you look at what he did in the Jungle Book, Elba was fantastic. I mean, the casting from a voice perspective in that particular film was dead on. Everybody in that movie was fantastic. So I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I enjoyed his presentation as well.
Speaking of James Bond, I don't know if you saw this, Reggie, the actress in The X-Files, Gillian, what's her last name?
Anderson.
Anderson had posted something about herself as the next Bond, and it got picked up a lot. Do you think that could ever happen, Reggie?
Yeah. You can lobby for a role. You can do that. So, yes, I think that it's realistic that it can happen. It really just depends on the chemistry of who they're going to have play that. And so, you know, they'll have a few – they won't do the Bond – because it sounds really sexist to me, Bond girls until they actually solidify who they get in for Bond.
Hmm. Well, a big remake coming up, going back a little further in August, Ben-Hur. This is like one of those classic old style movies. What do you think of this?
I'm scared. I am really scared of... I've used these terms so much today, saying iconic and classic, but this is... classic. I'm like, are you really going to do this? Seriously? And the answer is yes. And so I don't know. This is not a film that I would say, okay, guys, let's. I wouldn't green light this one. But they're doing it. They have a solid cast for it, and of course. The person who is in every movie, it seems like, this year, Morgan Freeman is in it in some kind of way. He's in almost every movie. He's in Now You See Me 2, and he's in this, and then he's the voice of something else. He's the voice of God. I mean, hail to Morgan Freeman.
We'll leave it there. We left some on the cutting room floor. Reggie, thanks for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Reggie Ponder, bringing us up to date on the big summer movies coming out. He's known as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago.